You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this incredibly gorgeous Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Dagnolo, broadcasting live from Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios, high above Camelback Road. My guest tonight on the Otto D Show is an incredibly gifted writer, whether writing songs or books or articles for publication, his work always touches his audience in a personal way. Brian Smith will be with us right after this track from Fervor Records recording artist Mail Order Brides called Knock on My Door. Check it out.
Listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was Knock on My Door from Fervor Records recording artist Mail Order Brides here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you tonight by Fervor Records and Fauna Films. You can find Fervor at fervor-records.com, and you can find Fauna Films at fannafilms.com. And as always, thank you so much for listening. So let's get to it. I'm excited to introduce to you a very talented guy that many of you may already know. His name is Brian Smith. He's the former frontman for groups out of the valley such as Gentlemen After Dark, the Beat Angels, and the Pills. He's also a journalist and an accomplished author, and he's live from his home in Tucson, Arizona this evening. So good evening, Brian. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, Otto. How are you?
I'm doing great. How's the weather in Tucson? Just like Phoenix?
So lovely. It's beautiful. I wouldn't change it for anything.
Well, that's good to know. You know, you've been in town and out of town because you were in Detroit for a while. Now you're back in the desert. How's that feel?
Well, I was in Detroit for 12 years working at a newspaper, and it was pretty damn glorious, I have to say.
Pretty damn.
And I went back in Tucson because my heart was broken, and I had nowhere else to go.
Okay, well, we're gonna cover all that again. But you said pretty damn glorious in Detroit.
Well, I'm certainly in love with things that are sort of desolate and broken. I mean, I'm naturally attracted to that sort of thing, and that's what Detroit is.
It's, yeah,
you know,
that's interesting. That's very interesting. You know, you've been on quite a creative buzz the last couple of years. I mean, you've put out 2 books. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, the new book's coming out in November.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're doing a we're doing a book launch in Phoenix on November 11th at Valley Bar.
Okay, that's going to be a lot of fun.
We're actually doing one in London on October 24th at the big bookstore in downtown London, whose name escapes me.
That's pretty cool.
But we're signed. I got signed to a UK publisher for the second book, and it's basically a collection of these essays and columns and things, mostly based on the stuff I wrote for Tucson Weekly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was kind of scanning through some of it, and what blows me away are the descriptions and the comments you're getting from other writers about your work. My goodness, if people were saying that about my work and they were my peers, I'd be pretty thrilled. You're held in high regard by a lot of other writers, and that has to kind of validate your transition from music to print.
Yeah, that is really amazing. It's like some miraculous fluke, you know. And it's funny, a lot of my favorite authors chimed in with this new book, like Willie Volutin and Jonathan Evanson and Margaret Regan and Kevin Canty, and it is really validating. And you know, half the time I feel undeserving. You know, it's like I've never really had much confidence in my abilities over the years. And
I still fight
with that stuff daily. You know, that internal thing, like, hey, you're not good enough. You know.
Yeah.
But it's funny, man. You talk about the transition from music to writing. Even in my earliest days in the Pills, and before that, I always wanted to be an author, you know, but I needed to meet girls, and I got in a rock and roll band, and it worked fabulously. Yeah, hey, be a singer in a rock band, and that's how you get the girls.
Yeah,
I mean,
then
writers don't get girls.
Right, then you become the author, because then you already got them. And the book tour is really different than a band tour. You're on your own without all the guys and all the gear. It's got to be a little bit different vibe.
Yeah, well, we're doing a lot of literary shows on the Spent Saints book tour, and the fact that we even got to do a tour is pretty amazing, because that book surprised the hell out of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it sold, it was basically word of mouth, and so we started doing these tours, and we kept selling books, and the books allowed us to keep touring, but we did something very different for that, and I think it helped. And one thing we did was we did shows with bands. Like one time, I did a reading at a record store, in the back of a record store in Nashville, between a couple of punk bands. One band, the Tough Shits, who were amazing. And I was more nervous doing that than I was opening, like
you
playing.
Yeah, you would have grabbed a mic. Yeah.
Supporting Alice Cooper, you know, in front of 18,000 people. I was more nervous to do the reading in the back of a record store between two punk bands.
Yeah,
because it's just me
that.
And
yeah.
These kids. There are kids there, and I think I won them all over reading a story about drug addiction and alcoholism and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But I had no idea what the response would be, and I think I won them over. But man, it was that kind of thing is really difficult, and to do readings and to even do this sort of thing with you is a. These kinds of things are really hard for me.
They're not your comfort zone. They're not the normal place.
No. And it brings me back to, like fronting, like, Beat Angels and Gentlemen After Dark. I was always drunk, you know? And so it's like a whole nother person would take over. And
do you think that was because of your nerves? Because it was just kind of easier?
I was really nervous, and so I'd always drink, and then you know what that leads to. And that
right.
was... My relationship with alcohol hit a bottom in Detroit when I nearly died. But
wow,
which was amazing because it gave me a lot to write about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can imagine. But I did want to ask you something. I've become more intimate with John Lennon's works in the last few years for a number of reasons. But I didn't really. I heard in an interview where he once said, "I only write about myself because it's the only thing I know." And then
right.
I was reading some remarks about Spent Saints, and one of the things someone said was all of his characters, and they started listing all of the stories, and I thought, sounds a lot like all the characters were Brian. And I wondered just how much of what you were writing in those stories was as much projecting your aspect of the character into what you were writing.
Well, Spent Saints, the Lennon thing is great, and most of my favorite writers, you know, wrote from the depths of their rotten little souls, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. and just sort of what I did is I had nothing else going on in my life, and I'm finally going to write a book, and I did it, but I based everything on, I mean, it's memoirish in many ways, mm-hmm. but it's fiction, but a lot of the drug addiction, the alcoholism, and the new dancers, and the sorts of themes that run through the book,
sure.
are super topical in my life, and I wasn't trying to make it like drug porn or alcohol porn or whatever,
right.
porn. They were just like themes and things that I knew so well.
Right. It's the backdrop of your story, you know?
Yeah. Hopefully there's some redemption and reclamation involved in some of those stories. And, you know, I heard there was, and I, you know, it's hard for me to tell.
I heard there was, you know, it's, I like that. But I got to say, I've been wanting to get both of since I've been reading about them, I wanted to get both of the books. I have not picked up Spend Saints, and I feel really guilty about that. I don't feel as bad about the new one cause it's not out yet, but I spent quite a bit of time researching it. And,
thank you.
Again, the comments that people make. In fact, just because people aren't on your website necessarily right now, I just wanted to read a couple, because when an author can say something nice that's just compliments, because they're good writers, but when you have a writer say something about a work that really moves them, you can tell in what they say. And just a couple quick comments. Jonathan Evison wrote, keenly observed, humanely considered, and unquestionably lived. And this is one of the guys I think saw that this is about Tucson Salvage, but I think he really saw
right.
the depth of the work. And Dan Stewart, who I'm unfamiliar with, said that Tucson Salvage is holy work. Now, no writer says that about another writer's work starting no. off. Then he goes, no doubt about it, but done by a fallen altar boy who truly knows what it's like to feel completely alone, abandoned, all bridges burned, no direction home. I mean, if that doesn't paint a picture that tells you he was impacted by the book, I don't know what could. And so that has to draw you into wanting to read the book.
I'm living in hope. I'm hoping, you know, not many people read anymore, but I've got to tell you, guys like Dan Stewart and Jonathan Evanson, I'd look up to those guys, and I've always looked up to them. And, you know, Dan Stewart in particular, he's from Tucson, sort of from Tucson, and he was in the band Green on Red, but he's written okay. two really brilliant novels, and I really respect people who do the music thing too and then switch to literature at one point. Willie Valutin, same thing. Richmond Fontaine, and then his novels, which soar, you know, mm-hmm. they're major motion pictures and things, but yeah, no, man, that's you know, when people say that, I'm so flattered and so humbled and so feeling, like I said earlier, undeserving.
Okay, I understand that, but don't you don't have to worry about that. You're deserving, you know. It's amazing the talent you have. You have an ability, and again, it's in one of the reviews as well, but you just have an ability to uniquely observe the human condition, and then when you talk about it, you don't report it like it's just a matter of fact. You report all the emotional content that's expressed in the situation, whether it's an image or whether it's a moving picture. You just have a way to connect to it and see what and express the important part that there is to convey. And I think that's
Thank you
want to call that a talent, you can call it a talent. It's probably just more the way you are, based on, you know, what your life has brought you through. But then your ability to convey that and your words are kind of what makes it magical.
Well, thank you. That's a really nice thing to say. You know, and this, if it's conveying, we talk about, like, writing from a point of view that we know. Well, writing from a point of view that I know has always been a sort of deep sadness.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had this dark sort of passenger with me my entire life, this depression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm naturally drawn to things that are depressed and people who are depressed naturally, because I think I have an empathy for that. And
mm-hmm.
hence why I love Detroit so much, and why I really wanted to move to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
When I took a job there, and I had job offers in other cities, but I'm like, man, this is Detroit. The place is absolutely broken. And
you got there.
Oh, also, there's Motown and
right.
David Ruffin, and there's the MC5 and
Eminem.
Shit else.
It was all kinds of stuff out of Detroit, but you got there right before Detroit took another dive. You were there as Detroit really had a hard time.
Yeah, I bought a house, actually, and I lost it in 2010.
Ugh.
Yeah, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. I mean, right. and I've said this before, but I said, I'm going to live in Detroit. I'm going to write about the city of Detroit, so I'm going to live in the city, and I bought a house in the city. And I was like, I say this all the time. I was the only white guy for blocks and for square miles and square miles. I mean, the city wasn't very diverse. It was black.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this white guy, this is amazing. It's like these sons and daughters and grandchildren of slaves, you know, the Great Migration from the South. And I'm like, what are they going to think of me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they brought over, my neighbors brought over plants and fresh baked cookies and bread and these sorts of things. And I've never experienced that anywhere else I've lived,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I wouldn't trade Detroit for anything. And in fact, and something perverse part of my soul is a little heartbroken that the city is coming back in a really gentrified sort of way.
Yeah.
It's kind of ruining the soul, the way that at least that I sort of see it.
Well, that speaks to the unique perspective you have. And as a writer, that's what I think it grabs you, you focus on, and you present. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of people's observation. So you bring a depth of the reality of it to people in your writing. And I think that's what these other writers were trying to convey. And speaking of writers, I write, but I'm not a writer like you and some of my other favorite writers. Another local guy who's a dear friend of both of ours, who's a great writer, Serene Dominic. Salerno. He's a great guy, singer-songwriter. He's also been working at the same place, some of the same places you've worked in the past. I think he was maybe part of what got you to go to Detroit, or I'm not sure how that whole story went. Maybe we can go into that. But before you came on tonight, I reached out to Serene and I said, hey, man, you know, I know Brian, but I don't know him as well as you know him. Write me an opening for him. And so he said, sure. And he sent me this little note back. So I thought I would read this for you because I just thought it was really, really great.
So, Dominic.
So this is, you know.
Before I hear what he says, let me just preface this by saying I love the guy.
Right. Well, and who doesn't, you know? So he said, quote, Brian has been a guiding light in the Arizona music scene. First with his work with Gentlemen After Dark, then with the Beat Angels, where he put a level of literacy to rock lyrics that could rival Leonard Cohen and Lloyd Cole. He has since transferred that poetry, sans backbeat, to his writings in Spent Sates and Tucson Salvage, but it's no less musical to my ears. And now that's from your friend and mine, Serene Dominic. So I thought that was wonderful.
Well, he could have gone either way, I think. I mean, I knew Serene when I was at the lowest lows and strung out on drugs and alcohol and stuff, too. And, you know, he chose to be really kind, so I love him.
Look, we've all had our worst foot forward, you know, and we've all hopefully attempt to keep our best foot forward more often than not. But,
right.
You know, I've been an ass in my past plenty of times to people.
Of course.
You just try not to be when you get through that and you realize the mark you're making. Because I try to explain, I'm dealing with a teenager in my life now. And I try to explain, look, no matter what you choose to do, you're making a mark on all the lives you touch. You're making a mark. So you really want to kind of choose what kind of mark you're making. You know, there's no such thing as just ignoring everybody and not making a mark. That's not what's happening.
I mean, it's funny, the motivation behind this stuff. I'm not trying, in all honesty, it's nothing that I'm really doing. It's trying to draw attention to myself. I just do what I do. And,
right.
You know, and I chose, like with Tucson Salvage, I chose to write about people. It's nonfiction. It's not fiction. I chose to write about people that no one else on earth would ever write about.
Right.
You know, the working class, the whatever, prostitutes and junkies and those sorts of people, but also people who are just struggling to get by in this sort
right.
of version of America. So these stories are all like really American in that way. And these are my favorite people, man.
Mm-hmm.
Hardworking, blue collar. They're my heroes.
Where the dream is just like, to get a break, you know, and,
right.
and a little respite from the struggle that's life.
Right. I don't want to sound like I'm doing a PR pitch for my book. I'm just saying it's just what I'm attracted to,
mm-hmm.
the people who are struggling. And when I started doing these pieces for the weekly down here, I was like broken. I was in Tucson and I had nothing and I was suicidal. And I just wanted to write about people. And I started doing that. The Tucson Weekly said, well, we'll run it. And I'm like, okay. And I mean, my thought first was to pitch it to like Washington Post or the New Yorker or something. And that would have taken years just to get published, you know,
mm-hmm.
and this thing, it just happened. There was no plan to make a book or anything. That just happened fairly recently, like the beginning of this year, even
mm-hmm.
late last year. And so, yeah, I mean, and since I'm talking about it, and since we talk about how you see the writing to be sort of visual, we did a documentary based on some of the stories in the book, and actually my wife, I know that sounds silly, but my wife directed the thing.
Why does that sound silly?
Well, because it's...
Because you have one after all this? You've survived a long time relationship?
I've had a number of wives over the years. No, I met her... It's a funny little story. I met her... she was doing publicity for Spent Saints, and that's sort of how we fell in love. But she used to come see Beat Angels play when she was 16.
Oh, wow, cool.
And I had no idea, and I didn't remember her really or anything. And then she called me out of the blue one day to edit her novel because she's also a gifted writer. So I said, okay, but you have to pay me because this is what I do for a living. And so that's how that started. And she got hired on to do publicity through me at the publisher, and then we fell in love. So
awesome.
You know, the cook always gets the waitress, or the waitress always gets the cook, or however you want to look at it. But
well, I think that's fantastic, and I think that if when you guys are working together on something like that, it kind of helps. Having the two minds about it.
She happens to be a filmmaker, and so she said, this would make a great doc, and I'm like, okay.
Cool.
And the documentary is done, and we're going to debut it in Tucson and Phoenix in November and London
next month. Awesome. That's fantastic.
But it's actually, I have to say, and I'm not just pimping this stuff, it's really good.
I don't doubt it. Considering the content.
Yeah, it's these are my people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm excited about that. I was unaware of the documentary, so that's kind of exciting. So now let's if I can drag you back through your music career a little bit. In this market anyway. You really have been during a particular era kind of the face and style of what everybody wanted to be. And watching you on stage going crazy, you're running around, jumping around, it was like there was no lack of confidence, or you were the man, period. And I think everyone I ever ran into always talked about you as that showman, as that leader. And we both have a friend, Jameson Weddle, who we've talked about. Jamie was, you were probably one of the people that he idolized when I met him. And I think I kind of became one of those because he wanted to be a record producer, and we worked together closely for 20 years since then.
Right.
But,
helped him.
Yeah, I helped him along. But when I told him you were going to be on the show, he's like, oh my gosh, I could tell you so much. It's because of you two that I'm in this business.
Oh, that's but, really funny.
But he's like,
he's really good at what he does.
In a way, it was crazy. Like, you guys committed me to a life in music that I love, but man, is it a struggle. And nobody said it was going to be this fight, you know?
And nobody says.
Yeah.
Nobody.
No. And you have
that. In many ways, all of us should be dead. I don't know you
right.
More than I know Jamie, but I can say in all honesty that you know, he's pretty lucky in some ways to have made it through.
Yeah, I think everybody who does is pretty much. There's every opportunity not to in this business.
Right.
You know. And so getting back to some of your bands, let's talk about...
I love Jamie.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart. He's still my mastering guy. I still send all my work to him as a mastering engineer. He's teaching
That's
over...
That's amazing. The stuff Phoenix you guys College. Did with Nils Lofgren, stuff you guys did is amazing.
Yeah, and I just didn't do much. I did some work with Nils, and then when he built his studio, Jamie got to start doing Nils' personal stuff, which has been great. Then what was really cool is after Jamie did his last record, he did the mixes, and Nils was going to have, I think he said he was going to have Clear Mountain mix them. But, you know, it's like one of the cats who sang on the record, one of the other famous guys, I can't remember who it was, I don't think it was Lou Gramm, but somebody said to Nils, no, the mixes are great, leave them alone. And so Nils kept Jamie's mixes on the album, which I thought was fantastic.
That's amazing. I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah.
I knew he mixed it, but I didn't know Clear Mountain was involved.
He was going to be, and then they said, no, they're good enough. Why would you want to do that? So I thought, what a compliment.
Beautiful.
You know, what a compliment.
Well, that's how rock and roll is supposed to be anyway. It's what works best, right?
Yeah, so he's doing well and hanging in there. So, but let's get back to some of your bands. Like, which one was first? Was it the Pills?
Yeah, the Pills, we were teenagers. I was a little kid, and I didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground, and none of us did. And I should have been in high school, but I quit. And back to that, I was reading a lot of books and stuff, and that was my education. And we formed this band. We came out of the Tucson punk rock scene. We were one of the first punk bands in Tucson. But we had a love for the Heartbreakers and the New York Dolls, and I idolized Johnny Rotten and Alice Cooper and I don't know, whoever else.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in, we did the first record, the only record that Fervor just reissued. And I think at 17, 16, I think at a certain time, I'm sorry if I'm sounding a little inarticulate, but I'm trying to remember. But I remember thinking and knowing that certain times when we were on stage, we were the best band in the world.
Right.
A couple of times we probably were, and I could say that about Beat Angels too, and they were such fleeting moments.
Right.
But they were we were really good a few times, and I'm like untouchable. And you know how rock and roll used to be, that it's a spiritual, this is visceral thing that comes from the gut, and mm-hmm. you just know it when it's working.
Yeah.
When everybody else is tuned in as well. And so we had those moments, and the Pills, that's probably what ruined me for so many years, was chasing that one feeling. And when I couldn't find it, I searched it out with booze and drugs and stuff, which mm-hmm. works for a while too, of course.
Yeah. But, then you chase that.
No, but we made the one record, and it's funny, the Pills in Tucson, this was like 1980, mm-hmm. and boy, am I dating myself. But we were really young. I was a kid. We're teenagers, most of us. Robin Johnson was the guitar hero, and I was the front man. He was like my Keith Richards to my Mick Jagger, or, mm-hmm. you know, my Johnny Thunders, you know,
sure.
to his David Johansen, you know. But we did a great little record, and I got a ton of airplay in Tucson. In fact, DC-10 was a local hit for a while, and there were some DJs over at KWFM that loved us. And Johnny D and Phoenix played us. And
cool.
And we were like the band that was going to be huge, but of course it didn't happen. You mm-hmm. know, in those days you could still be huge playing rock music, and
yeah.
so
yeah, it was the dream.
We sort of fell apart in a haze of like tender addictions and alcohol and things. But so boy, now, were we good sometimes. And I couldn't sing a lick, but I tried.
The Pills, did you guys get out of Tucson, or was it primarily a Tucson performing band?
Well, we played, I mean, in those days, you couldn't just tour, man. It was
right.
like you had to be on a major label, and we tried to get on a major label, and a couple of people would come and see us and say, they're too punk rock, or they're too glam. You know, at that point, it was, or they're too pop or something. It was always something too, you know. But it was really difficult to tour, but we did get to start playing in Phoenix. And I remember we started playing in Phoenix, and then in those days, the bands playing bars were doing like four sets of covers a night.
Right.
I mean, the Jetsons were playing like, or is Billy Clone the same, or turning into the Jetsons, were playing like Roxy Music songs and, you know, or whatever for mm-hmm. four sets. And mm-hmm. we blew in playing a couple of New York Dolls tunes and playing a 40-minute set.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of changed things in a way.
Yeah.
But
interesting.
But we found an audience in Phoenix, and we promptly relocated out of Tucson.
Okay.
There's an indifference in Tucson. It's like a difficult place if you're, I think, playing music or an artist or anything. And there's still a kind of indifference here, and I can't explain it, but mm-hmm. it's a sort of a bitterness. But we had to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not to diss Tucson. I love it. That's why I live here, but I was born here, but still, for what we were doing, we had to get the hell out.
Mm-hmm. And so the whole band came up to Phoenix?
Yeah, we did. We had a drummer. He got in a serious car accident and nearly died. So we collected Winston Watson, who was actually playing in a Russian Led Zeppelin cover band with two kick drums and everything. He was our drummer. We just plucked him out of this band and said, you're Charlie Watts now, and he had stripped his kit down to a snare and a kick drum and a tom and some cymbals, you know,
right.
and he was an amazing drummer, and he could groove like anybody, like Al Jackson Jr. or something. And he's, you know, he wound up playing with Bob Dylan for 6 years and played with Warren Zevon and Alice Cooper and all sorts of people. But
wow,
he was
cool.
He was in the Pills when we changed our name to Gentlemen After Dark, but we also recorded one song as the Pills called I Walk Alone, which funny enough was in an episode of, I'm jumping around here, but that song was in an episode of Glow, thanks to Fervor.
Cool.
The Netflix show Glow.
Yeah.
And that song literally was collecting dust in a bottom of a shoebox on a cassette.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and they rescued it.
Well, you know what? Maybe we should play that, because I wanted to play something from the Pills from the Fervor's reissue. So should I pick that one?
Okay, sure.
I was going to play Hollywood Doll, but we can play, you know, I'll Walk Alone.
But DC-10 was the hit. That was the hit.
Yeah, I remember that. I listened to that one. I thought
you could play I Walk Alone.
Yeah, I thought DC-10 was the most, probably the most punk of them all. Don't you think? It was kind of
no. DC-10 was the acoustic driven.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Us trying
I'm
to be
remembering the wrong
Jackson
one.
Brown.
Oh, that's right. Cool. Well, let's play I'll Walk Away. You can grab yourself a drink of water, and then we'll be right back here on the Auto Dude Show with Brian Smith. So here's I'll Walk Away with the Pills on the reissue on Fervor Records.
Listening to Auto D coming at you live.
Hey, and this Thursday at the Crescent Ballroom in downtown Phoenix, there's a show going on with Ghost Cat Attack. They are making their first, or I should say their debut performance at the Crescent Ballroom, so they're pretty excited, and they're recording a live album. So if you can make it down there on Thursday to show support for these guys on their first gig there and their new live record, I think that'd be cool. They've invited three other bands that have never played the Crescent before, which is the Lighthouse, Secret Destroyers, and the Psychedelephants, which I think is a pretty cool name. And that was Brian Smith fronting the Pills on a track called I'll Walk Alone from the Fervor Records reissue. And that's a pretty cool little tune. And that was on Glow, you say, Brian, recently?
I'm sorry?
Was that song on the show Glow recently?
Yeah, it was recently on Glow. Episode 6, it was the lead-off song for
that's
the episode.
That's pretty cool. Did you get to watch it?
Yeah, it was pretty... I did. I couldn't believe it. I almost fell out of my bed.
So. It's kind of fun, and it's neat to think those old tunes have life because you own the master, and there it is. You know, you can do something with it.
Right. I know. It's amazing because you know, we're on the soundtrack with Madonna and whoever else and Erasure and stuff, and it's the Pills. So, you know, I wrote that song with Robin Johnson when we were teenagers, so wow. 17 or something. And like, so there's a certain beauty to that, and, you know, but I'm sort of kind of frightened to go back and relive it, but it's like being a tourist in my own life.
There you go. I was going to say, you don't have to go back and relive it, but it is kind of like a tourist.
Right.
You're a different person looking back.
And
I wanted to ask you something.
You know, also I have to say about that band is my brother was in the band too, my older brother, Barry.
Okay.
And on that song, he played keyboards and Fred Cross played bass, and our original Pills drummer, Rex Estelle, who was also really gifted. We always had these gifted drummers, always throughout my life had gifted drummers. He was the one who was hurt really bad in the car accident.
Mm.
But he wound up being okay later, and he wound up playing drums again and stuff. So he's fine.
That's kind of cool. I wanted to ask you a couple things. Your father was a musician, right?
Yeah, he was.
Is that how you got into it?
He forbid all of us to get into music, which is precisely why we all did, my two brothers.
You know, parents never learned. Don't say no. Say yes and then go, oh, hey, look at this shiny ball.
That's right.
That's pretty funny. What did he play? Was he a guitar player, a piano player?
He's a saxophone player, and he played guitar. He originally started on guitar and played in a number of bands and where he grew up in Missouri, and then switched to saxophone. And then when I grew up in Tucson, we had these big bands practicing in our living room, and they were his bands, and he would arrange all the music and on sheet music, and they'd have these rehearsals in our living room. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a lot older than me, and when I was a kid, and so his music was, his era was the tail end of the big band stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his thing, was like big band and jazz.
Interesting.
Beautiful stuff. He was an amazing musician. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard a story once, and I want to ask you if this is true, because you're the one in the story, so you're the source. You can tell me. Someone told me that you were actually credited with coming up with the name of the Gin Blossoms.
Doug Hopkins was this was a long time ago, and a lot of people probably debate this, but we took it right out of Hollywood Babylon, the Kenneth Anger book, and there's a picture of W.C. Fields with the big bloated red pustuled nose, and the caption said W.C. Fields and his Gin Blossoms or something. I go, hey, that'd be a great name for a band. And I was with Doug at a little place in downtown Phoenix. He goes, that's a great name for a band. And that's how it started.
You know, that of all the things I've ever heard, that makes the most sense, and I can see that. I can just see that.
Yeah. And you knew Doug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that just makes total sense.
Actually, we wrote a movie about the last days of Doug's life that's making the rounds. I probably shouldn't really talk about it, I've been working on that for years and years.
So when you say making the rounds, since we can't talk about it, is it just a screenplay right now?
It's a screenplay, yeah, but there's interest in stuff, and Doug's sister has been really kind, and, mm-hmm. and his state and helping in with some of the music and things,
mm-hmm.
The rights. But I mean, it's all just talk right now. But,
sure.
And which leads me to wonder why I even talk about it.
Well, listen, you know what? The music business,
I probably just jinxed it.
In the music business, everything was talk. But in the movie business, which I've been in for a few years, everything is talk because it's so much bigger and it moves so much slower. It's so much work, you know. But it's worth it. I mean,
yeah.
I love playing around in film. I just love it. I've shot my own first feature. I've edited a number of films for other people, and I've written a few screenplays. And now I'm shopping a few screenplays to try to get them, in a sense, in one fund with one group of investors to do these movies. And so we should talk after. If I can help you, I'll help you.
I've been through this, and we just went through this with our documentary. And
I bet
the funding. Came through, and
that's fantastic. And
also, we made short films based on. We had different film directors made short films of all the short stories in Spent Saints, and
cool.
Those are all entered in festivals right now. And
awesome, man! That is so cool. I'm so excited for you because this kind of work that you do, it's you need a bigger stage so people can see it, and the visuals are really what's going to propel it. I think I'm just thrilled for it.
I just hope it's hard to sell books because not that many people read, and people who do read don't really buy books. And so
yeah,
we're
it's
talking
tough.
About a very small percentage. It's like all the things I love in life, it's just appearing, like books and records and albums.
But now look, you love writing screenplays and stories for TV and film, and think of all the places that are demanding video now. And you're married to a filmmaker, so you're set. She needs stories, man. And then that's all you got. You got tons of them. So there's a real potential future for your creative process, I think. But I also wanted to ask you a couple more questions before we get too far down the road here. How did you end up working at New Times here in Phoenix? How did that happen?
That was really fortuitous because I was living in downtown Phoenix. I live in the Garfield neighborhood, the Barrio, and I was fronting Beat Angels, and I was out of money and I didn't have any work, but I started writing. And by some miraculous, because I read a lot of books, like I said, and I figured I could write, and I always wanted to be a writer. So I started writing porn movie reviews. My launch into my literary career was through porn.
Any door.
And I started writing porn movie reviews for this guy. He was in this 80s metal band in Phoenix called Surgical Steel. This guy, Jim Keeler, really sweetheart. He had this little porno magazine in Phoenix, and he hired me to do some writing for it. And that led to me writing for some different national magazines for a lot of money and doing these porn reviews because people really responded to those.
And Who'd have thought? But the thing is, when you start to get paid for a job like that, a creative job, it's become something worthwhile.
Yeah, then the porn company started delivering all these movies to my house. I mean, there's a story about this in Spent Saints is actually really true. And I got really strung out on drugs and pornography. And I'm telling you, pornography is not good for the soul. And,
right.
And I nearly lost my mind. But anyway, anybody who's listening can go buy the book if they want to read about that, because that part of it's true. But I started doing feature writing for a magazine called Planet in Phoenix. I don't know if you remember the Planet.
I do not.
And then Phoenix New Times, man, Jeremy Voas, the editor over there, and David Holthouse and a couple of the others, they really liked what I was doing, and they gave me a column, and I started writing about people in the Phoenix underbelly. And sort of what I do now in Tucson is the people, like I said earlier, I'm attracted to, you know, the ones who are hurting are the ones who no one else is paying attention to, and the ones who have the real stories that I like, you know. And I started writing these stories, and then they hired me on time, full-time. So as a full-time staff writer, and at that point, a full-on alcoholic and drug addict. And I remember, and I've said this before, I just remember the first staff meeting, I was like sitting next to a Harvard grad on my right and a Columbia grad, Amy Silverman, on my left. And here I am, this high school dropout alcoholic. And at that time, Phoenix New Times had a really incredibly gifted staff of journalists, and they were the best in the state, easy, and there I was. Mm-hmm. So I was in pretty good company, but I have to say, New Times, literally, those guys, Andy Vandervoort and even Mike Lacey, they lifted me out of the gutter, and I'll forever be in their debt.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the editors over there, Kate Nolan, and Jeremy Voss, they taught me so much about the actual act of writing, about getting in a chair and getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not be a writer if it wasn't for Jeremy and probably Kate.
That's kind of cool.
Time.
So that was really your serious. That was your serious education. Was that gig?
Yeah, that was my education, and I certainly didn't. You know, and over the years, and I've on the Spent Saints book tour, and I've did a lot of speaking in like creative writing classrooms and. On university campuses around the country, and I've spoken at journalism classrooms as well, University of Michigan, for example, and I even did a thing at Northwestern on the Spent Saints book tour. And then, like, I always say it's probably not a good idea to follow my route into writing because, I mean, I nearly died, and I didn't go to school for it. I just... And anything could have happened, and you know, by some miracle, I escaped the things that could have derailed me, you know, and wound up being able to make a living as a writer. And to even make a living as a writer is something. And
yeah,
I am forever grateful.
It's a pretty rare thing, you know, someone who makes a living as a writer. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and then to be able to talk about it at a university classroom and hear a high school dropout.
Right.
Okay, here I am.
Yeah, but
here I am.
Exactly.
And the students ask really good questions. The ones who read the book and have, you know, did the work, they ask the smartest questions, and it's really, you know, it's really kept me on my toes. But people seem to be fascinated with the story of somebody who didn't go any traditional way into this.
Yeah, but you know, that's kind of how things work. When you're forced to do what you do, because this is, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to go to school. I'm going to do this. People like you, I'll say, people like us, we have no tolerance for what we don't want to do. We're spending our life, and we're not going to spend it doing that. So we go down a path that no one in their right mind would go, because they're not thinking like we are. You know,
do you think that's true?
I think that's part of it. I think that we have a passion we can't deny.
Don't you think that some of it's motivated by fear? I mean,
oh yeah, yeah.
I wound up in places I normally would never have wound up if, you know, if I wasn't so scared of my own shadow. That I would not have been like doing drugs or drinking or something. In some of the places in Phoenix and stuff where,
yeah, I think I wouldn't send
my worst enemy. These crazy rooms of meth cooks and dealers. And
so you can say you were fearless, you know.
More terrified.
Yeah.
I can say fearless now because it makes me look a little more virtuous, but no, it was mostly fear.
Yeah, definitely fear is a motivator, especially when we're young in terms of our choices. We're avoiding what we don't want, so that's part of it, I think, too, yeah.
But for some reason, I didn't go down the tubes like Doug Hopkins. I didn't take my own life.
You came close. You dealt with depression. You dealt with a tough struggle.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, that you guys were.
So that's why I'm. Yeah. Have to remind myself even to be just eternally grateful to be here.
Absolutely. And I think that's what the kids take from you when you talk about, you know, don't follow my lead. Well, the thing is that your path, as much as you don't want to condone somebody following your path to understand and be able to express the way you do, it's the way that life hurt you that gave you a recognition of the pain, a recognition of the place, and that's kind of where you come from. They'll never write like you without living life. Let's just put it that way. They don't have to live the same life, but you have to live a life to be able to speak on life, you know?
Well, that's what I like to say to myself when I'm really, really beating myself up.
Well, think of it this way. You're a martyr for the rest of us. You had to go through that so that we could understand what life is like. You know, you express in such a beautiful way. Who wants to make us all go through that to get it? You know, so you've paid a price for everybody who reads the book. And I think that's how you touch people. Well, I just think it's the truth. I think that's why you touch them. And all of these writers who respond the way they are responding just is proof of that. It's not me. They're all saying it, you know.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned, I'm thrilled about the film work that's coming up for you to bring some attention to it. That's going to be fantastic. And also, I just want to thank you for taking all the time you've taken to spend with me today. And do you want to spin another track before we end?
Yeah, we didn't even talk about Beat Angels.
We didn't get that.
Gentlemen of the Dark. But I will say, I mean, thanks to Fervor. I will say thank you to Fervor because they rescued the Masters and put them on their label, and like I didn't want the Beat Angels stuff to languish. And
mm-hmm. Are they going to do some stuff with the Beat Angels as well?
I know they bought the Masters, so they have that, and they have a lot of the Gentlemen After Dark stuff too. But the Beat Angels is near and dear to my heart in many ways. And
can you tell me a couple reasons when you say near and dear to your heart? Can you give me a couple examples of why that one stands out?
Well, the last Beat Angel stuff we ever did was never released, but it was the best stuff we ever did in terms of like how the songs sounded close to how they were supposed to sound in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it came close to finally getting that place where you just get the goosebumps from the tip of your toes to the top mm-hmm. of your head. And I was never able to achieve that with the other bands, but with the last stuff we did with Beat Angels, and Gilby Clark produced it, but we
cool.
became such a good band, and I was a much better singer in the studio. I can never get that down, and it all came together in those last recordings that we did. And then I went to Detroit for the writing gig.
Mm-hmm. Now, are those tracks some of the ones that Fervor has? So we'll actually hear.
They don't have those yet. We're still working on that.
Okay,
it's like She Shoots Starlight. There's like 8 or 9 songs that were going to be the third album that never came out.
Okay,
and
Let's spend one more Pills cut, and then we'll come back and kind of talk about a little how people can get a hold of you and follow you, you know, in terms of what you're doing. So should it be DC-10, or should it be, what else we got?
Yeah, let's hear DC-10.
Okay, so DC-10. Tell me a little bit about this song.
Well, Robin wrote the music, and I wrote the words. Robin Johnson, who's an exceptional songwriter in his own right, and he was just strumming on an acoustic guitar and made up this tune, and he had a father, and this is loosely based on his dad. It was K killed in an airplane crash in Minnesota. It wasn't a DC-10 or anything, but he told me that story, and I sort of rearranged the words to make it pertinent to that song in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, as a 16-year-old or 17-year-old, I wasn't very good at that. So what came out was a little off, but that's the genesis of that tune.
Yeah, it's I remember hearing it and kind of chuckling a little because it's just interesting. The lyric, you know, I realize you're talking about a plane crashing. You know, it's like, wow, it's kind of wild. So
yeah, but it's a little cynical in its
of course
way, and
yeah.
I didn't want it to be cynical. But we were punk rockers into wearing eyeliner and around Tucson and getting beat up at Circle K's.
Yeah,
that was the life. All right, well, let's check it out then. This is Brian Smith fronting the Pills, probably in 1980, I guess, would have been released.
Yeah, that was probably 80. It came out in 80, yeah.
With a cut called DC-10, and then we'll be right back.
Listening to Auto D coming at you live.
And that was DC-10 from the Pills, fronted by Brian Smith, my guest this evening. That was a fun little song. And that's on the reissue from Fervor. So,
yep.
Has it been a long time since you heard that one?
It was, and I'm listening now and I'm thinking.
Oh,
it's really. I could tell that we were listening to, like, Emotional Rescue at the time when we recorded that. And we had a manager telling us we were going to be huge, and he had done a bunch of tours of the Rolling Stones. And it just made me think of Mark Smyth, a guitar player. He was, like, so much older than us. He was 22. We used to call him Grandpa. And what an amazing guitar player he was.
That's really funny. 22, he's Grandpa. That's great. Well, listen, yeah, man. Again, we're kind of on the end of the hour. I want to thank you so much for your time. And I really want to just sit down with you and after I read the books and just have an opportunity to ask you some questions about it, because it's, from what I see, it's just incredible work, and I know you. It's just going to be something to read. I'm really looking forward to it. And how can people follow you? What's the best way to reach out to you?
Well, I have a website, briansmithwriter.com or tucsonsalvage.net. I mean, those are the best ways. Or I'm on Facebook.
Okay. And have you got any...
No, I want to say... Can I say one thing?
No, you can't say anything. It's my show.
I remember when I moved to Phoenix, though, I remember like when we first came to Phoenix, and I remember Glenn DeJean and Bruce Knoll, and I remember thinking, these guys are writing the best songs in the world, and nobody was hearing them.
Right.
And suddenly now, it's like, you can hear them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, meeting Glenn DeJean, and I listened to his interview that he did with you, and... that guy, I will say, that guy was writing some of the best songs in the country at that time. So some of the best pop songs. And I remember thinking, nobody's going to care.
Yeah.
And here's some, it's sort of like, all these old guys are getting their due. It's quite nice.
It's neat because, you know, TV needs that. They have these period pieces. And because Fervor has created relationships in the pipeline, they have an opportunity here, especially the folks who are here. You know, so it's been kind of cool. What's in the works for you, man? Have you got another book in the works, or have you got any music in you that you're thinking about tracking?
You know, I'm the writing is like pretty much full time, and when I'm done, I can't really do much else.
Right.
Plus, I have my wife. I married into a little family, so I have a 5-year-old son now, and
that's a lot of work.
I don't know if you've ever chased around a 5-year-old, but it's pretty tiring.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work.
So much.
I'm not. I don't envy that picture at all. So, but congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
So it's a lot of. It is going to be a lot of work, but you know, it'll keep you young. That's for sure.
Here's hoping.
Trust me, I'm sure it will. Well, listen, man, thanks again. And if anybody
Thank
wants
you,
to
Otto.
Get a hold of you, we'll just hunt you down online. With best, I would say, recommend to people to go to your website. I posted the link today as well, briansmithwriter.com. You can read some of these reviews of the book, and you can you know, kind of read some of the excerpts. It's pretty incredible stuff. So we'll see what we can do to help you with that project.
Thank you, Otto. And I hope I didn't make a fool out of myself.
When? Tonight? Are you kidding?
Yeah, I just get talking about the old days, and I just tend to ramble.
No, man, it's fantastic. The truth of your life and the stories are what, you know, kind of create what you're doing now, and it's wonderful to share that with you.
So, thank you.
Yeah, man, and we'll talk to you soon, and take good care.
Okay, Otto.
All right, take
care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.